Back at it midweek, Wednesday, April 29th, right here on Connecticut Today with the ever-changing coronavirus situation. We spoke with an area college professor. What will national security and geopolitics look like post-COVID-19? Our own Marietta Kemmerer checked in with something she's doing very special for some area pet owners. Governor Ned Lamont had his daily COVID-19 update, and commuter columnist Jim Cameron checked in with us. We haven't spoken to him in a while. He talked about what future commuting trends might look like.
Yeah, there's always a political end to this stuff, too. We're seeing that revved up more and more and more. And joining us right now from the University of New Haven, he is a professor looking at all things political, too, professor of national security and politics. Dr. Matthew Schmidt is on the line with us. Dr. Schmidt, Paul Pacelli here at WICC. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Good afternoon.
Well, great to have you here. Well, as you all know, as you probably figured, this kumbaya moment of battling this whole thing, is, I get the sense it's kind of like morphing into now, hey, there's a political angle on this on both sides. Let's talk about that. Are you surprised now that we may be seeing a little light at the end of the tunnel on this, and now the finger pointing, which was kind of under control for a bit, is now kind of bubbling to the surface here, or not?
No, not at all. I mean, my view of politics is less the idea of partisanship. And that politics is really about deciding who gets to decide things in situations like this. Who gets to decide, how we're going to get ventilators? Are we going to pre-stock them? Are we going to wait for GM to make them? Who gets to decide whether or not we're going to issue shut-in orders? And so those things are always there. It's just that the unknownness or the uncertainty of the crisis, except for the certainty of the gravity of the crisis, tends to suppress value fights over those decisions, values being sort of the conservative versus liberal spectrum.
Interesting, yeah. And I think a lot of people, Dr. Schmidt, going into this, as I've talked about with, some constitutional experts, I think a lot of people maybe were under the impression, perhaps erroneously, that a president has all kinds of power over everyone and everything in this situation, when really the governors here, and I think that surprised a lot of people who didn't understand that, Dr. Schmidt, the governors here have as much, if not more, authority than anyone in the White House.
Yeah, well, that's the same question of deciding who gets to decide these things, right? And that was the question that the framers took on when they put together the Constitution. And their decision was, we don't want one executive, like the king, to make all of these decisions. And so we will distribute out, right, in the Constitution, a range of different kinds of decisions that different kinds of executives get to make. And in this case, as you said, right, the governors get to make a lot more of these decisions than I think most people appreciate. And that's basically because in the last century, the presidency has gained power. And we've lost track of the idea that Congress is really seen to be the essential branch of government.
Dr. Matthew Schmidt is the guest, Associate Professor of National Security and Political Science at the University of New Haven, talking about the whole political dynamic to all of this. And obviously, Dr. Schmidt, with that variance in power, with that state-level authority of governors, I think it's left a lot of people who don't really understand that scratching their heads a little head, saying, hey, wait a minute, why am I locked down here in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut? And I'm turning on the news, and people in Kansas are playing golf, and they're getting their hair done, and the drive-ins are open. Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
The NCAA's on.
Okay.
You're right, right? So the situation here is that the virus poses a problem in that it doesn't respect the borders. It doesn't know if it's in New Jersey or Kansas or California. And yet we have a system that allows governors to function and make these kinds of decisions, these kinds of commands, inside of territorial borders that just don't matter to the disease. And so there's a real tension there, and we're trying to figure out what's going to happen. What's going to happen if Georgia and Atlanta open up and then the disease blooms in those places, and then it gets transferred back to more dense urban places like New York, right, or San Francisco. And who gets to decide that? Like, why should the governor of Georgia get to decide something that may put the city of New York in danger? And that's the pressure we're all trying to work out, and we don't know the answer. We've never been here.
Now that, and Dr. Schmidt, that's exactly what I was going to say. You know, I know we've had Ebola, and we had SARS, and we had MERS, and we had the bird flu, and we even had polio that some of my older relatives lived through and they still talk about. But, man, think about it. Me doing this kind of a show, you in the classroom with students, this is something that hasn't happened on this scale in 102 years. It's mind-boggling.
I don't think it's happened ever. Because the disease itself might be, you know, similar to the Spanish flu in 1918, but the interconnectedness of the world in which this current virus is happening, the trade routes, the communication, like we're talking, you know, over the internet and the airwaves, the way I'm teaching my students online, the way that people are ordering things, you know, on Amazon, the existence of the internet, none of this has ever happened before. And so the virus is challenging us physically, it's challenging us psychologically, and it's challenging us to reimagine the sort of post-internet world and the world with this kind of intense globalization that we've come to accept as the way the future is going to be. And it's an open question now as to whether the future is going to look, you know, like it did 10 years ago, and we're just on a pause right now.
And
it's going to look very different.
Yeah, and also, Doctor, I thought, and I've been saying this a couple of times during our coverage of this, yeah, you're right. As much as we wonder about the future and the realignment here, also, though, I thought that in a way this also kind of knocks us back a couple of decades to, you know, small town America, where you go out on my streets, and I live in Wallingford, and, you know, this, you know, town of, what, 40, 45,000 people. But, you know, the streets are a lot more desolated, even on a nice day today, like they normally would be. There's a lot more people out there walking, saying hi to each other, walking their dogs, people congregating, just talking. There really has been, in some way, kind of a humbling experience to all this, and maybe forcing us, I don't know if I'm waxing poetic here, but forcing us to appreciate the little things again?
I think it is. And I think that psychological effect is going to linger, and we're going to, in some ways, miss, you know, quarantine. We're going to miss being, I mean, I have three kids at home. There's some things I will not miss about being quarantined with three young children. But I will miss a lot of the special moments that I get because I'm not, you know, in my office or in my classroom somewhere else. And I think everybody's feeling some of that. And we're going to try to retain that. I think we'll have more work at home when we come out of this. Mm-hmm. I think we'll have more self-sufficiency in our local places on the expectation that we'll be in more of these kinds of situations as we go into the future. And I think one of the things that you know, listeners need to think about is that a few years ago, I think 2015, somewhere around there, we crossed a really important threshold, which was that more people on planet Earth were living in what were classified as urban areas than rural ones, which again has never happened in the history of mankind. And so you now have a fundamentally different kind of social structure as a dominant structure, which drives disease and drives social patterns, drives economic patterns, and you know, and of course contributed to what you have with the coronavirus, right? Wuhan was larger than New York, and it's only one of many cities that are larger than New York in China. And those kinds of things matter in terms of, you know, how we decide to live when this thing is done, and whether or not we're going to have more waves of different pandemics.
Dr. Schmidt, hang on just a minute. You brought up China. I want to get into that and the whole international side of this when we come back. The U.S. and China, Dr. Schmidt, before we took the break here, it's interesting, a little note that you brought up that I have mentioned before, and people don't realize it. You know, they say this, all these diseases came out of this place in China I never heard of. Well, like you said, hello, Wuhan is bigger than New York City. Yet, we have very little of an understanding about places like that. And I think that kind of adds to our cynicism and our kind of not so much distrust of Chinese people, the average working Joe in China, but their government there.
Yeah, I think there's no question that the government delayed reporting and then reported inaccurately, and that caused governments delays in being able to react. But I think also governments, our government and others, right, reacted more slowly, even given that, than they should have. And so I think there's blame on both sides. And just because there's blame on China doesn't mean we should absolve our own government or other governments for missing these signals. And China is facing a situation where this is quite embarrassing for them and is likely to have long-term impacts for them too. I would be surprised if major manufacturers like Apple and many, many others really that manufacture in China don't try to diversify a lot of where their facilities are. And so you might see some percentage of facilities moving to places like Mexico or Turkey, places that are closer to final markets in Europe or the United States in case of future pandemics.
And obviously still, Dr. Schmidt, afford U.S.-based companies somewhat of a discount in manufacturing costs, because you and I both know that, in fact, there was a story I read about this in the Wall Street Journal a few years ago, that, okay, you want to build iPhones here in the U.S. and Apple and even some of the Android makers, fine, bring your factories to the U.S. Well, prepare for the labor costs then to hike the prices on those phones, you know, about $200 a piece. What's the American consumer going to say about that?
That's the open question.
I think
they will absorb a lot of those costs. Well, companies will absorb them to meet the price point that consumers will accept. And in large part, companies will decide that larger short-term profits will be traded off for stable, smaller profits, right? Still good ones. But that's what's happening here. I think one of the other things that gets left out, we tend to use, you know, Apple and Ford and GM as these kinds of big examples, but you have a lot of smaller manufacturers in places like Camden or North Haven that are producing, parts, valves, right, things like that. And what happens is they go to China and they have this item and they've designed it and they want to mass manufacture it, but they don't have the technology to do it. They don't have the wherewithal to design the manufacturing process. And there'll be factories there that will say, we can do that for you, right? One of the services that we provide is the ability to do the production design that you can't. And so one factory will produce a lot of these sort of single products for many small American companies. And the problem here is that if you go to a place like Mexico or Turkey, it's unclear that the production design capacity is as developed. And so there will be costs that might keep some of these producers inside the Chinese market because they have access to production design capabilities. The good side is it might force American colleges, right, such as my own, to produce more engineering graduates who can offer those kinds of production design capabilities to, factories that are located closer. But that will take time, and there will be a cost in that delay.
And also internationally and on a national security basis, Dr. Schmidt, again, this is, I think, going to serve as, you know, a real big wake-up call. And we're seeing countries like the U.S., like China, like Iran, like Russia, for example. All of a sudden, the Russians have started to be more forthright about their coronavirus cases. All these countries that are normally, you know, waiting with a finger over the button and threatening each other, it is kind of a humbling moment from Mother Nature to say, okay, you can have all the bombs you want, but, you know, we don't have to fire a bomb here in nature, and still we can take out hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, that's one of the big things in the national security field, is that the number of people who died in armed conflict last year has been far exceeded by the number of people who have been killed by this pandemic. And so that radically shifts what we think of as national and international threats. And it, you know, it poses the question to countries like Iran or Russia or China about what they have to do to protect their own citizens and how far they can go with, you know, demonizing other countries, like they would demonize us or we would demonize Iran or something. Because Americans tend to forget that there's actual real politics that happened in Russia, even though Putin is a strongman. There's real politics that happened in Iran.
Yeah.
And if the population isn't taken care of, then those politicians and those systems are at risk, which is why they're starting to open up and respond better to the coronavirus.
And people forget sometimes, you know, Dr. Schmidt, that, you know, albeit that the Shah was as brutal as he was to some of his enemies, you know, Iran was had much more of a Western flavor before the Iranian Revolution of 1979. And, you know, had Mr. Putin not ascended after Dmitry Medvedev, you know, after Perestroika and all that in the Reagan years and Gorbachev, you know, Russia was kind of teetering on almost becoming a democracy.
Right. I mean, I'm a Russian specialist, and the thing is that Putin was the darling of the West at the start. They were worried about the resurgence of the Communist Party in the latter half of the 1990s. Bill Clinton set over, you know, Paul Begala and other economic advisors to advise Yeltsin's campaign to make sure that he won. But then when he did win, the concern was his health, his alcoholism, the corruption in his administration, and Putin was seen as a stabilizing influence on that. And then emerged, you know, later as the authoritarian figure that we see today. And, you know, and that's, again, that's one of these situations where there was politics in play that produced the Putin we know today. And there will be politics in play in a place like that, dealing with, you know, who his successor is, you know, in the next 10 years. And what happens in places like Saudi Arabia when, you know, when oil prices stay down and who the successors are there and what those systems will look like in a post-corona world.
Fascinating stuff. He's an associate professor of national security and political science at the University of New Haven. Dr. Matthew Schmidt has joined us. Dr. Schmidt, thanks so much. We appreciate the time. Stay safe, and hopefully we can talk in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Be well.
We hear her on the weekend, 7 to 8 p.m. Sundays, live talk with Marietta, and Marietta Kammer is with us. Hi, Marietta. How are you today?
Paul, how are you? A little under the weather today.
Oh, my God. Are you okay?
Oh, I'm fine. I think emotionally it's just getting to me when you go out. The roads are just about empty. Grocery stores, you get an eerie feeling. Mm-hmm. And as I'm heading home to Monroe, where I live, I see a funeral procession that I had to wait for at the stoplight. And they only had four cars following the hearse. And I broke out in tears. Yep. So I'm a little under the weather.
No, that's that. Listen. You know, we as human beings, we're not used to this, but I think we will all get through it. Now, you wanted to tell us all about something you have very special coming up. So go right ahead.
Yes, I want our audience to know that I'm not in the dog in the pet business, but for 14 years, actually much longer, I have always helped people every single year with various projects, whether it's about giving out food or coat drives. And this year, we want to help the pets. And I really feel when people go through adversity, the best thing a person can do, help others. It works for me, Paul. It has always worked for me. So, and I got a hold of a pet food sponsor, and I talked to him about it, and they said, absolutely, we will give out for 3 months free pet food for dogs and cats. So that was quite an accomplishment, because who does that in you know, today? So I'm very happy. And we're starting with this sponsor May the 5th.
Okay.
So tomorrow, April 30th, is the deadline to sign up.
Okay.
So, and people can have free dog and cat food. It's given out once a month by us.
Okay.
And what they have to do is they have to go to my website.
Okay.
KMAREducation.org. Now, that's spelled like Kmart without the T.
Okay.
KMAREducation.org.
Okay.
And sign the little form.
Got it.
So we need to know who they are, if they have a dog or cat, and where they live. That we need to know.
Right.
And they send in the form, and I will give them immediately a reservation code, because we're still giving it out curbside.
Got it. Okay. So KMAREducation.org is the website. The sign-up itself ends tomorrow, and the giveaway or the first distribution will be on May the 5th. I got that all right?
Yes. You may the 5th. Just to like give people an overview, it's from 11 to 3.
Okay.
And it's only by reservation code. So let's say, yep. Paul, you're coming. You're 102.
Yep.
You come. You drive up. You say 102, and you're handed a package for your doggy or for your cat. Because I know if 102 has a cat or a dog, that I know,
oh,
and what
I got
your
it.
Name is and
okay.
everything.
Got
yeah.
it. Now, yep. where's that pickup point going to be?
It's going to be at 477. Main Street in Monroe. That's okay. right in the Clock Tower Plaza.
Yep.
And our sponsor, and I do want to mention them, their Natural Pet Outlet Store.
Great, great. All right, so that's good stuff. So I'll go to
good
Kmar.
Not,
good, yeah, go
not
to kmareducation.org.
Yep.
The sign-up runs through tomorrow, the 30th. The first distribution will be May 5th, 11 to 3. 477 Main Street in Monroe, in the plaza there. And Marietta, you're right. You know, during these tough times, if we have a rough day, a down day, our pets are always there. Our dogs, our cats, and they give us that unconditional love. Yeah.
I know it. My heart goes out. And yeah. many, many people are affected. A dollar matters.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And pet food is not cheap. So this is wonderful food that we have for the people. And, you know, I can't thank Natural Pet Outlet enough. And I said to them when I first met them, because we had our first giveaway.
You know what?
Another,
oh, there she is.
Yeah?
I'm sorry. No, I lost you momentarily. Go ahead.
Sorry. We had another April the 1st. We had our first drive. And
I remember
that.
People, yeah, because you and I talked about that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Very successful. We had over 30 WICC listeners coming, and I was able to give to three shelters, including
Great.
The police people in Bridgeport.
Excellent.
So, but people have to understand they have to reserve, they have
okay.
to get a number. Otherwise, we won't have enough food there, and it will be chaos. This way, it's nicely managed, and everybody just drives up, gets the food, and off they go again.
All right, Marietta, thank you. I will give out the information several more times before we wrap up today. All right, Marietta, thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Just going to go with the first page of this today, the daily summary. Again, it shows a positive trend that we have seen now for over a week, and that means hospitalizations continues to go down and that the positive cases are 455, nothing positive about that number, by the way, except that it is a smaller percentage of the number of tests performed. So I think this is all relatively good news in terms of what we're trying to accomplish. And with that, I'd just like to introduce to you my great friend, Rudy Marconi. In the meantime, you can look at the other graphs, which are sort of similar to what you saw before. Rudy, as you know, is our first selectman for life, we all like to hope there in Ridgefield, does an amazing job there, been a good friend of mine for a while, and got hit and hit hard by the COVID virus, some days ago. And I just wanted him to tell a little bit about his story and what we can learn from it as the rest of the state tries to figure out how fast we get back to work. Hey, these social distancing laws are getting kind of tiresome for me. Rudy, tell us what you've learned. It was quite an ordeal.
Sure, Governor, thank you for having me here today, and I want everyone to understand that the reason for me telling my story is not one of looking or searching for any kind of pity or understanding, but more understanding the virus itself and the devastating consequences that it can have, especially from a health perspective. And I know we're all looking at the economic side of things, and as a capitalistic society, we want to get back to work. We want money to flow again. But I can't stress enough the importance of how this can impact the health of all of our citizens here in Connecticut. And back on April 4th, I came home from a Board of Selectmen's meeting feeling somewhat down and had a head cold. And now at that point, I went to bed, stayed in bed Thursday and Friday. On Saturday, I was tested. And on April 6th, that Monday got the positive results. By Wednesday, the 8th, I was pretty far down the road into this virus and working with several doctors here in our community, my PCP, primary care physician, recommended at that point that I get on oxygen rather than go to the hospital. I was on oxygen for 8 straight days, 24/7, being on the hydrochloroquine and azithromycin combination with Tylenol and vitamins, and I can't begin to name everything. The most amazing drug for me ended up being Zofran, which helps reduce the feeling of nausea, which was perhaps my most difficult symptom to deal with. And I can't tell you how severe I felt from laying on the floor and having difficulty in the evenings to finally being here today to tell that story. More importantly, for everyone to understand that, and as I said, and at the risk of being repetitious, that we cannot open too soon. Please believe me. This is a highly contagious, serious virus that we need to be careful each step we take. And as the governor just said, our cases continue to increase. The number of deaths continue to increase, although hopefully slowing. Just here in my own little town of Richfield, we've lost 30 people. We're approaching 160 cases, and it continues to be a problem, and there are contagious people. And until we can get testing going, and we're working at that from every corner imaginable, to be able to control the statistics and have a better understanding, have our people feel more comfortable in society. Until we can get that point, let's work together, continue to social distance, continue to wear the face coverings, and not pressure people to open. That can be perhaps the worst single thing we could do right now. Let's do it once, do it right, and listen to the governor, please. He has us on the right track. Thank you, Governor.
Well, thank you, Rudy, and we're cheering you on every day, and you're looking good, man. And that is a message that we're getting a little cabin fever. I understand the stay at home is getting a little tiresome, but when you hear a positive case of COVID, I want you to think of the human side of this and how it hits people and hits them hard, Rudy. And Rudy's here to answer any questions you may have. With that, let me just introduce to you Susan Bicewicz, who needs no introduction, our amazing Lieutenant Governor. As you maybe know, she's been taking the lead in terms of making sure that our census does an accurate count. She's done an extraordinary job. I think that we have the highest percentage of people who have responded to the census, 57%, she told me, compared to any of our New England states. And, you know, that's not unimportant because the more people we have registered in that census, what that means in terms of revenues coming back to the state of Connecticut and what that means in terms of congressional seats. So I thank her for what she's done there. And given that experience, given her incredible understanding of all of our local communities here in the state of Connecticut, she's going to be heading up our long-term recovery committee. As we slowly get on the backside of this pandemic, you heard from Rudy. There are a lot of folks who are hit and hit hard. There are a lot of seniors who maybe are quarantining. There are a lot of folks who have perhaps some distress and anguish and mental health issues. And we're trying to put together committees in each of our local communities to look out for those people. And that may mean of folks from education, not-for-profit, the religious community, as well as the political communities. And I can't think of a better person to lead that effort than Susan Bicewicz. Susan?
Governor, thank you so much. And I'm very happy to tell you that as of 3 o'clock this afternoon, the state of Connecticut had a 57.1% self-response rate. So we continue to lead all of the northeastern states, and we've been recognized for our efforts by the United States Census Bureau. And one of the reasons that we have such a high response rate is we have local complete count committees in almost every community across the state. There are 156 registered complete count committees. Rudy Marconi has one in Richfield, and most mayors and first selectmen do. And the reason I mention this, Governor, is that it has proved to be an incredibly effective model for engaging community partners in the census effort. In order to have a successful economic recovery after this catastrophe that is COVID-19, it's been a catastrophe for our public health and it's been an economic calamity, we are going to need to rebuild at the local level. So today at 2 o'clock, I launched with the help of the Council of Small Towns, the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities, and the Connecticut Conference of Governments, and other partners, the long-term recovery committees. And with the help of these municipal organizations, what we're going to do is we're going to ask each community in our state to choose a coordinator. And we're going to ask our municipal leaders to identify someone to be that coordinator of the recovery effort in their town or city. And that person will, with the help of their municipal leaders, come up with a group of community partners. And those community partners will include businesses. It will include philanthropic groups. It will include community groups. And these committees will be diverse. They will represent different segments of the community. Diversity has been really important, and community engagement has been really important in the census process. And many community leaders have already started very vibrant census committees, and these could be models for how these long-term recovery. So we are really excited to help the communities, each community leader, put together faith-based groups, philanthropy, businesses, and other community organizations that understand the community needs. And those groups will work with our state long-term recovery partners, their legislators, and our federal partners to maximize funding, to make sure that community needs are met, and to recognize what the local conditions are. Because what we know about our state is that each part of our beautiful state is different. Eastern Connecticut is different from Litchfield County, is different from some of our urban areas. And we think this is going to be a very effective way to bring our economy back on the other side of this, and to bring it back in a very strong and effective and inclusive way. And we've seen the success with our local complete count committees with the census, but we've also seen that this approach has been very effective during the 2012 recovery efforts after Sandy and Maria. So happy to take any questions, and just want to say thank you to our municipal partners. And Governor, it's been your collaborative leadership that has shown us the way. We've been working with governors from our area, and you've also been working in a very collaborative way with our municipal leaders. In fact, you and I will be on a call with them, our weekly call, at 5 o'clock. So we really view this as an extension of the collaboration that we've been doing from the start of this crisis, from the start of our term, actually, and over the past year with the census. So, Governor, thank you so much for the opportunity to help.
All right. Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Rudy. I had mentioned yesterday that we might have Representative Jane Garibay on as well, and perhaps she'll call in. I thought she'd be a very interesting participant because she's got a political perspective. She was afflicted with COVID, and she runs the Chamber of Commerce. So if anybody had a pretty good perspective on balancing, COVID opening and business, she would, and maybe she'll be calling in a little bit later. But short of that, Max, let's see if we have any questions.
News 8.
For Rudy Mulcahy, explain to us
just as Rudy, when you first get the call, you test positive, what's going through your mind? Take us through the emotional. You are in the wheelhouse for the virus, the age-wise. So I don't know, what were you thinking? How did you quarantine, and did anybody else catch it?
Nope.
Okay. Hello? I'm here now. Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
I can hear you.
Yeah, to answer your question, that was April 6th when the local health director called me to say I was on the list released by Danbury Hospital. And it was a mixed feeling, not sure what to anticipate. Hadn't really looked at anyone who had gone through the symptoms and suffered through the aches, chills, pains, sore throat, headache, nausea, diarrhea, you name it. Any symptom you've ever had in your lifetime hit you all at once, at least in my case it did. And it was pretty alarming for me, scared at times. My wife was frightened, was in constant communication with doctors, worried that I was disconnected. She was losing me, calling the hospital, seeing if they could transport me or our local EMS services. But fortunately, I was able to stick it out here at home and come through it. It is a very sobering impact that it can have on you and the reality of life and how precious life is. And that's why I cannot stress enough in the governor's leadership here to let's practice the social distancing, the face covering. Let's get our numbers to where we need them. And let's be sure we can control this, because God forbid, I don't want anyone I know to have to go through what I did.
Did your wife catch it? How did you quarantine with your wife?
Yes, she did. Although we practiced the isolation, there were times when she had to come in and check on me. Very concerned of catching it. She did have 2 days of a very low-grade fever, dressed it with Tylenol, and has been great ever since then, but will be tested as well with me on Friday for hopefully what is a negative test.
Thanks, Rudy. Associated Press.
Good afternoon, everyone. Governor, is there any way to tell right now who is getting infected right now? Who is being hospitalized at this point? Can you tell from the data if it's medical workers, relatives of people like Mr. Marconi's wife, or nursing home residents? What does the picture look like? Can you tell at this point?
I don't think the picture. I think the picture is sort of disparate. Obviously, we know early on what the geographic dispersion was. Lower Fairfield County, coming up from New Rochelle and New York City. That was very clear. Now we know that we're in certain neighborhoods that are more densely packed, Bridgeport, Hartford in particular, where you see the infection rate and the hospitalization rate going up the fastest. And when it comes to testing, we're going to be prioritizing those communities, because those are the communities where you can have another flare-up with the most risk to communities. Anything else on that, Josh?
I guess no. Okay. Governor, also, is the state planning at all to help shield businesses for any kind of liability if they reopen and their workers get sick? And also, is there any plan to ban unemployment benefits for a worker who voluntarily decides not to return to the job because they're afraid for their safety? Or maybe on the flip side, maybe there are protections for workers who are afraid to go back to work.
Yeah, first on the liability issue, by the way, I was very happy to see Senator McConnell sort of walk back the bankruptcy statement, and he says he is going to be looking at some support for state and localities. That's really important. And he did couple that with the possibility of some liability reform for a business. I got to think about that. I mean, I obviously want every small business wants to do everything they can. I know that, to keep their place of employment safe as can be. It's the right thing to do in a matter of your reputation. If you're going to get customers to come back to your restaurant, to your facility, your salon, you're going to bend over backwards to do that. The legal liability on that, I've got to think about a little bit more in terms of this is a virus that we don't know everything about. So there's a lot of risk on both sides of the aisle about how you structure that. In terms of people coming back to work, Sue, my instinct is we have safe workplace rules, we have safe store rules, and if they maintain those safe store rules, then I think you should go back. If you're, unless you're in a non-essential category. I think otherwise, people are paying you for that employment and it gets pretty complicated. But we'll try and work that out case by case because some situations may not be safe.
Welcoming back to the program here. We haven't talked to him in a while amid the whole coronavirus thing. Our buddy Jim Cameron, he writes the Getting There column stories for the Hearst, Connecticut media, all the papers around the state, watching commuter issues and all that. Jim, how have you been? Are you still hunkered down?
I am indeed. I'm doing well, thank you.
Well, that's good. Good, 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 good to hear your voice again. It has been a rather unique, a rather stressful time. Your latest piece, Flattening the Commuting Curve, and for some people that haven't seen that, that's got an interesting title to it. You know, how are we going to move forward here, Jim, in the coming weeks, months, year? I'm kind of intrigued to see all this.
Well, I think there's actually some good news ahead. Obviously, we have to wait until it's safe to come out of our shelter, so to speak, mm-hmm. and get back to our normal routines. But I think we've learned a few things during this period of quarantine, if you will.
Yeah.
And one of them is I think we have to rethink the whole idea of going to a 9-to-5 job 5 days a week. Obviously many of the trades like plumbers and things like that, they can't telecommute. But there's so many other people that live in southwestern Connecticut and your listening area who have remained productive, who have kept working from their homes. I mean, we have the technology now with computers and high-speed internet, et cetera, to work without necessarily going to work, going to an office. And I think even when offices in New York and Stanford and Greenwich and Bridgeport reopen, I'm almost predicting there are going to be some people who, for either reasons of wanting to stay safe or for convenience, for the quality of their lives, are going to go, hey, I don't want to be on a train 2 hours a day just to go to an office and sit in a cubicle when I can do the same amount of work productively from home. So I think we know that Metro North is now down 95% on its ridership. I don't think it's ever going to come back to the levels that it enjoyed pre-COVID-19. Similarly, I think the highways, which are near empty right now,
yeah,
we'll probably not get back to the bumper-to-bumper rush hour conditions that we saw, a few months ago.
You know, Jim,
so all
this,
of that, I think, bodes well for people who want to have more time for themselves, for their families, to do volunteer work, et cetera. They can still work without necessarily going to an office.
Yeah, I think so, and I've talked about that for, a few weeks here. I'm wondering, though, how willing businesses you're going to be want to do that. But maybe, Jim, if it saves them on the bottom line with square footage of offices, with utility costs, insurance, that may be the key factor here.
Well, I think even when they reopen, they may need to stagger their workforce so that half of the office comes in Monday, Wednesday, Friday. The other half comes in Tuesday, Thursday, just to keep that social distance that they'll still need within their office space itself. So the people that aren't in the office may be able to work from home. I've also heard anecdotally that there are some New York companies that are looking for satellite office space in the suburbs, Fairfield County and Westchester, so that they can have their personnel who live in the suburbs be able to get to an office space. But again, I mean, even if we go into the office, are we going to be sitting neck to neck, cheek to jowl in a conference room? No. Are we going to be going around and shaking hands with business prospects? Probably not. Even the simple act of handing somebody a business card is going to be slightly suspect. I think a lot of that will be done virtually. iPhone to iPhone, airdropping a business card or something like that. So when I say flattening the commuting curve, I mean spreading out the peak demand that we used to see Monday through Friday in the morning and in the evening rush hour, spreading out it over a few days, also over a few hours.
Jim,
I think that's going to mean a lot for the quality of transportation, which had been pretty crowded pre-COVID-19.
You mentioned Metro North being way down. Not surprising. Do they take a permanent sort of hit from this, Jim? Do you think that they'll do anything subsequent to this regarding scheduling or number of trains or cleanliness of trains? All they've been doing, you know, they've been doing all of that, obviously, since, you know, for the past 6 or 8 weeks. But what do you think's in the future of Metro North, if anything?
Oh, big change is coming, and I'm going to tease my column for Sunday's newspaper.
Okay.
There'll be a special section called Back on the Road, or The Road to Recovery, and they've asked me to write about what Metro North's going to look like, and I have an interview tomorrow with the president of Metro North. They're looking at huge, huge losses. I mean, they have spent, including the bus and the subway system in New York, $800 million just on improved security and safety for their employees. They've been losing $195 million a week in fares. They cannot operate the railroad the way they used to without the fares coming back. And without the riders, they won't be fares. The fares on Metro North pay more of the cost of the actual ride than any other commuter railroad in the country. The two or three times as much as any fares on like MBTA in Boston.
Sure.
So getting people back on the trains will mean, more money to keep those trains operating. They're not going to increase the number of trains until the demand is there. The question is, what is it going to mean to their employees? Will they be furloughed? Will they reduce the number of cars per train? I think they want to keep people spaced out on the trains. So we're not going to see a return to the kind of rush hour service we used to see for many months, maybe years.
Now, you said $195 million a week, Jim. Is that specifically for the Metro North branch of the MBTA?
I believe that includes the subway system
Too. Got it.
Which, has also been tremendously impacted. Take a look at the Bridgeport Transit a bus system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have not collected a single penny in fares in several weeks.
Wow.
You can ride those buses for free now because they want passengers boarding at the rear doors, not going anywhere near the fare box or the driver, just for security reasons. I think you're going to see some bus systems, I'm not predicting where, but I think you're going to see some bus systems going to a no fare policy. Ride the bus for free. Now, my scenario is wrong, and if people have to go back to their jobs, it may be that they're going to feel safer in their car than they would riding mass transit. And that may mean that 95 gets and the Merritt Parkway get crowded again. And when those conditions return, then people are going to have to do the math and say, okay, do I want to be in bumper-to-bumper traffic all the way into Midtown Manhattan? Even if my boss is paying, $100 a day for my parking, or should I take the train again? So, there's a lot of what ifs that are going to, play out in the months to come.
All right, Jim, we will look for that column coming up, Hearst Connecticut Papers, this Sunday, you said, correct?
Absolutely.
Jim Cameron, the Getting There columnist, Hearst Connecticut Media. Jim, thank you. We appreciate the time as always, and you stay safe, okay?
You too. My pleasure. Thanks,
Jim. There you go. Oh, how about that, folks, huh?